Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about Iran. In early August, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was sworn in for a second term as the president of Iran. The announcement that he had been re-elected, now this was back in June, led to some of the biggest street demonstrations to be seen in Iran since the 1979 revolution. At least 30 people died. Some people say more. Hundreds were arrested. This morning, we'll try to talk a little bit about the continuing dispute over this past summer's presidential elections in Iran, talk about Iranian politics, and also perhaps review some recent reports that Iran continues to move forward toward producing nuclear weapons. And our guest for the program is Alex Vatanka. He is a senior Middle East analyst with Jane's Information Group. That's the big international defense and consulting and analysis operation. He's also adjunct scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., and spends time following events in Iran, also in Afghanistan. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions certainly are welcome. We just ask callers to be brief in their questions and to stay on the topic. And we just ask that so we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different callers as possible. But certainly, questions from people who are listening are welcome. That's the idea of the show. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. And we do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So here again in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. Mr. Vatanka, hello.
Hi there.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
We certainly appreciate it. Well, I think it probably would be good, even though I think the events in Iran that followed the presidential election certainly got a lot of coverage, but I think it probably would be good to go back and review a little bit and talk about this very, very significant wave of protest that broke out immediately when it was announced that as a result of the presidential elections in June, this was on June 12th, that Mr. Ahmadinejad had been reelected. Tell us again, remind us of what happened.
You know, what happened was leading up to the 12th June presidential elections in Iran, we witnessed something we've never seen really before in the history of the Islamic Republic going back to 1979. We witnessed a very electrifying, in many ways, election campaign. And the reason for that was simple. The incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad decided to go on the offensive, and he did so by accusing his opponents essentially to either be against Iran's long-term national interest, or at worst, being corrupt economically. And obviously, this created a lot of fuss inside Iran because the people he were accusing were not just individuals on the margins of Iranian society, but part and parcel of the Islamic Republic. So these are members of the elite. And this essentially created this huge split, which we now still witnessing this sort of split, this divorce, this fight inside the regime to sort of continue. And it looks like it will continue in the near future. There are no signs that this is coming to an end. But if I could just put it in this way, perhaps, It was a purge. This was an attempt by Ahmadinejad and his faction, and it's very important to refer to them as a faction because that's exactly what they are. The faction has started the purge and is continuing this purge. The question is, how successful will they be in the weeks and months to come? And the other big question mark, at least for me, is the role that Iran's ultimate political authority, the supreme leader Ali Khamenei, will play. Will he go along with the sort of agenda of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad?
Well, there you raised a number of interesting questions we can follow up on. Perhaps I would pick that one because it certainly seems that so far President Ahmadinejad has had the continuing support of the country's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and that's certainly very important that he does. If he didn't, I'm not sure that he would be the president. So the question is, why do you think that, at least so far, the supreme leader has continued to back Mr. Ahmadinejad?
You know, that's a very good question, and frankly, the answer to that isn't straightforward. One way to better understand the calculations and the motivations that have driven Khamenei so far in the last few months is where he comes from. I mean, this is an individual who is supposed to be a spiritual guide for within the Islamic Republic of Iran. And if I could just remind everyone, Iran is a theocracy. So the regime continues to this day, 30 years on, to claim legitimacy based on sort of the religious credentials of its leadership. Ultimately, Ali Khamenei is supposed to be the most gifted, the most influential authority in Shia Islam. The reality is he never had the credentials to play that role. So when he succeeded the founding father, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, who came to power and established the Islamic Republic in 79, he's always had this issue. Certainly in my mind, he seemed to be perhaps paranoid is the wrong way of putting it, but he certainly does have questions about how he's perceived within the regime. So what he's done the last 20 years while he's been in power is, instead of looking to the clerical establishments for support, he's looked to the people in the armed forces, particularly the Islamic Revolutionary Guards, for support. And to this day, when you look at Khamenei, he's looking still, and the actions that we witnessed taking place in Iran sort of sustain this argument, I guess. He's looking to the armed forces to back him up. The trouble for Khamenei is that the armed forces are also backing, and when I say armed forces, by the way, I'm really talking about the Islamist militias here, not the regular armed forces. But they're also, many of them, supporters of Ahmadinejad, which puts Khamenei in a very difficult position. And final point on Khamenei is the alternative to Ahmadinejad doesn't exist for him, because the reformists, the opposition to Ahmadinejad, have so far sort of refrained from criticizing Khamenei as such. But ultimately, Khamenei suspects what the reformist opposition inside Iran wants to do is to overhaul the political system and to reduce the powers of the supreme leader. And that obviously is something Khamenei is fighting. But I suspect if Khamenei had an alternative to Ahmadinejad, i.e. he could choose a third individual, at this stage in the game, I think he would be very inclined to consider that seriously, because Ahmadinejad is certainly an individual who comes with a lot of baggage and is politically very risky for the survival of the regime.
Yeah, there's another interesting dynamic here, and you touched on it, that is divisions within the, let us say, the clerical establishment. And I think that probably for a lot of people, they think that what's going on here, the political division in the country, is between reformers who are opposed to Ahmadinejad and the clerical establishment that is all lined up behind him. But in fact, that's not the case. And the controversy following these elections has, and perhaps the divisions were there before, but certainly it has highlighted the fact that within the clerical establishment, there are divisions.
There are huge divisions, and these divisions, by the way, have always existed in Iran. I mean, if you go back to when this republic, this Islamic, was created in 1979, from day one, from the outset, there were many grand ayatollahs. Actually, I cannot think of one single grand ayatollah, and by the way, these are the most senior religious authorities in Shia Islam, the dominant religion in Iran. Not one single grand ayatollah recognized or accepted the concept of the supreme jurisprudent, i.e. the supreme priest ruling over the country, both in terms of religion and politically. So this division is something that goes back from day one. What we now witness, or have witnessed since 12th of June, is that it's coming much more to the fore in terms of the public debate. And now you see grand ayatollahs, and these are there are less than 20 grand ayatollahs, and they can be pretty influential in terms of shaping the debate. They're now questioning where Iran is heading politically. And again, this is one of those, something I alluded to before, the risks that are attached to Khamenei being so close to Ahmadinejad, these grand ayatollahs are saying to the Supreme Leader Khamenei, what are you doing supporting this radical populist individual? And what about the consequences of his policies? And now you can look at those consequences in a whole host of areas, foreign policy, arguably the Iranian nuclear program, the poor economic situation in the country, and so forth. So, you know, Iran has always had, the Islamic Republic has always had huge divisions within it. What we had before was, because of a number of reasons, they kept that debate behind closed doors, and that's no longer the case. Now it's out in the public, and it's very acrimonious, as we all have seen in recent weeks.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Alex Vitanka. He is a senior Middle East analyst with Jane's Information Group, particularly interested in looking at Islamic affairs and developments in places like Afghanistan and Iran. He was born in Iran, in fact, but primarily has lived in Europe and has done a variety of different sorts of things for Jane's. He's also an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about recent politics in Iran. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. There was, as we have mentioned, and I'm sure as people know, there was a very immediate and dramatic reaction by opponents to the government when the results of the election were announced. Officially, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad received something over 62% of the vote, and his nearest challenger, the man who emerged as the focus of the opposition, Mir Hossein Mousavi, got almost 34%, and there were a lot of complaints about widespread fraud in the election, something that the government denied, said, no, there were no problems, this was a good election, and they certified the results, and Mr. Ahmadinejad was sworn in for a second term as president. Is there any way to say for outsiders, is there any way to say anything reliable about how this election was conducted and whether, in fact, there was widespread fraud?
You know, David, I'm probably not the right person to talk about exactly what needs to be done to make sure you monitor how healthy elections are in a given country. I was an election observer in Ukraine in 2004, and I can tell you those of us who were sent in to monitor those elections, we actually had a function to fill. And we went out in the countryside. We actually went to places where people voted and monitored everything. We wrote reports, sent it back. Now, compare that to what happened in Iran. No independent or outside, I should say, observers were allowed in. The Iranian authorities said there's no need for it. And just to highlight how you can criticize the entire process, the individual who was in charge of running and monitoring these elections, making sure they were free and fair, at least in the Iranian context, was the Minister of Interior, an individual who was appointed to that job by the president. So essentially the Minister of Interior was going to make sure his boss was going to get elected. At least that's how the Iranian opposition looked at it. And when the Supreme Leader then actually came out and said he thought the election results were a divine blessing and, you know, in his eyes, were a sign that, you know, the gods were behind Ahmadinejad and he should have a second term. Khamenei, the Supreme Leader, made that statement before the Ministry of Interior actually had released the official results. So, you know, if you look at this from the day after the elections were held, on that Saturday, the 13th of June, it just went wrong. And I think it even in the Iranian context, and that's by no means a perfect system, they broke a lot of rules while they were trying to make sure Ahmadinejad got to have his second term. Mm-hmm.
And it seems one of the interesting things here is that it seems that the country's top leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, seemed very much to be caught off guard by what happened.
No, absolutely. I think there was a definite issue here of overconfidence, not just on the part of Ayatollah Khamenei, but also Ahmadinejad. I mean, they did not expect the mobilization on the street level the way they, you know, ended up having to face it in the days that followed the elections. What I think, is the big difference here, because, you know, the fact that this regime would not be in power if there were genuine free and fair elections in Iran, I think most Iranian analysts will agree that would be the case. They would be out of power. I mean, if you had free and fair elections in Iran, there would be no theocracy. And just to make that point, 476 people decided to run in these presidential elections, and four people were allowed by the relevant bodies to actually enter the race. That tells you about how limited the political process in Iran is. And despite the fact that they excluded so many candidates, they ended up having this very nasty fight among the four, Ahmadinejad against the other three. And I think that tells us something about how overconfident Khamenei was and Ahmadinejad. I mean, if you look at the videos that are still available online, you witness how reckless Ahmadinejad was in his accusations against not the people who were running against him, but also their supporters. And as I said before, he was going against the entire establishment in many ways. And we're sort of faced with Ahmadinejad's radical language when it comes to the nuclear program, when it comes to New York and so forth. But he did exactly that, and you just have to magnify it at home for the Iranian electorate. And it, you know, as I said, it backfired, and we don't know exactly how many people ended up being killed by the security forces, but it's dozens and dozens of people. And that is an indication of how Ahmadinejad managed to miscalculate and mobilize the population against himself, and by extension against Khamenei.
Yeah. We have a caller. Let us talk with them. Someone on our toll-free line, someone calling from Piatone, and this is our line 4. Hello?
Yes, good morning. Good morning. There'll never be free elections in the Middle East for anybody. There's too much at stake for the corruptness to be wiped out. If you had free elections, then, you know, what would happen to the poppy trade, the drugs that they have out there? What would happen to all the Zeeks or Sheiks and, you know, the little tribal factions in the corner of the world there? I think we got to the point where we need to get away from there, and I firmly believe this. Ahmadinejad is going to do whatever he wants to do, and nobody's going to tell him otherwise. And I laugh when, you know, you talk about fraud. Well, wasn't there fraud in our election? So how are we any different than them in that kind of case scenario? Because the last guy that we had in office seemed to be bought and paid for, you know, in our election. But having said that, I think the Middle East in general, I don't know why people even mess with it. You know, for that matter, why do we have to mess with anybody else in the world? We can't even run our own country. I'm very skeptical about us trying to meddle with them, talking. I don't know. Do you think talking would be a safe point? Or, I mean, do you think, is there anything that people, not just us, in the rest of the world, could talk to them and see? I firmly believe it was fraud. But, you know, again, who are we? We don't live there, and we don't know what kind of strife goes on and on a daily basis. And I don't know. I'd like your comments on that and see what you think. Thank you.
Sure. Well, thanks very much for that. One thing I say quick, look, I mean, the Middle East is very, depending on how you sort of define it, it's a very broad region. It goes from Morocco to the borders of Pakistan, Afghanistan, home to some 350 million people or so. I mean, many, many countries within the Middle East. And to sort of generalize, I think, wouldn't really help us understand the region. And you certainly do have places in the Middle East that are very different from one another. I mean, Lebanon cannot be compared to, say, you know, Bahrain and Saudi Arabia cannot be compared to, Tunisia. So we have to be careful not to perhaps simplify matters. But another point you sort of raised was, intervening or getting involved. The United States actually, to my knowledge, did its utmost to make sure it did not even be seen to be meddling in the Iranian election. Because, I mean, there is the legacy of the 1953 CIA-instigated coup d'etat in Iran, and the U.S. doesn't want to repeat that. So the Obama administration, to its credit, made sure, and I mean, some of his critics obviously would say that that was a mistake, that the U.S. should have been supporting the opposition much more forcefully and vocally and so forth. But the fact is the United States said, look, this is an internal Iranian matter, and let the Iranians deal with this. And I think it would be also a mistake to say Ahmadinejad is going to win regardless. In Iran, you have, at least in terms of neighboring Middle Eastern states, you have the most dynamic civil society. There is a genuine hope, and I think the prospects are good in the long term, for this civil society to at some point make its mark on the political system by creating something that's very different from what they have in Iran today, the theocracy. This is exactly what the Iranian opposition is seeking to do. They're saying, look, we don't want an American intervention in here. We do not want another bloody revolution, but we want to fight this within Iran to make sure that the future of their kids sort of safe and sound, and that's how they're dealing with it. This is why Mousavi, Mihosseini Mousavi, the main contender who faced Ahmadinejad, made a big point when he said, look, I'm not going to question the authority of the supreme leader. I'm just going to go after Ahmadinejad, knowing full well what his limitations are in terms of his powers. But within the structures of that he now has at his disposal, they're trying to overhaul the system. And I think, you know, we can't just dismiss it and say there's no hope for the Middle East. They're trying. And, you know, these things are not going to happen overnight. But what I can tell you this, what you've seen come out of Iran the last 3 months, we haven't seen for the last 30 years in Iran. And we haven't seen anything like it anywhere else in the Middle East. So, you know, the potential positive consequences of the process that we're still witnessing can be just dismissed, and it can be actually pretty good for U.S. security in the long term overall. And bear in mind, final point, that you can't just leave the Middle East. You can't just leave the United States as the sole superpower, cannot leave a region with 60% of the world's oil and gas. Its economy depends on that flow of oil and gas, and a whole host of security issues. So just packing up, you know, the bags and leaving is not really an option, although I can see the attraction to it in the sort of short term.
Well, I have several callers, and I promise I'll get to these people right away. But I think that the caller does raise another good question, and that is, what is the potential for reasonable dialogue between the government of Iran and the governments of, you know, whatever other powers you want to choose, the United States and its friends and allies in Europe?
You know, well, you're absolutely right. If you look at the last 4 years, Ahmadinejad being the president since August of 2005, that record has been dismal. But that's not to say there's no hope whatsoever, because I think one thing we've got to make sure is we don't read too much into the powers of Ahmadinejad. He is one individual who is pretty influential. And actually, I personally think he has performed much better than in terms of consolidating his power than might have been expected when he took over in 2005. But as I said, there is an individual called the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei. He, by the way, is the final authority over the Iranian nuclear issue, over their ballistic missiles, over relations with the United States. The question is, who do you have to deal with in Iran to make sure you get to face individuals that are actually people you can negotiate with and serve U.S. interests? Now, that has been the issue that has slowed U.S. policy towards Iran, sometimes stopped it altogether the last 30 years. But again, you know, you've got to try to find out. And I think that's exactly what the Obama administration is trying to do.
We have some callers, so let's take the next in line, and that's someone here in Champaign County. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. This will be a bit heretical as usual, I guess, but seems to me appropriate. I, as you said earlier, you're not the right one to ask about what the election results really were, and I'm not either. I did see some early surveys and calculations that show that Ahmadinejad was going to win, not by the margin, and I don't think that even people that are going to win sometimes try to steal the election to make it look even better, which actually obviously backfired. But I'd like to start back with the whole idea of CIA meddling. I'm not talking about these ridiculous show trials and confessions that are being elicited or have been until they found out that they weren't really working. But, you know, 2 years before the end of Bush's term, $400 million of CIA destabilization money was authorized with assent by the congressional Democrats in the U.S., and that's a lot of money. It can go over a long period of time. It can start the ball rolling with the Baluchis or the various other dissident factions and minority Arabs and that sort of thing. And I think that kind of destabilization probably went more to perhaps getting Ahmadinejad election than anybody is commenting on. There was an explosion on the border at a mosque on the border, near the border of Afghanistan and Iran, just several days before the election. That kind of destabilization, you know, we kind of, well, it's a blip on the screen for us, but in Iran, that would be quite a thing. And you might say, well, it might have been black, it might have been a provocation to ensure, and I can't dismiss that, but it is on the record, though not commented much on, that the U.S. was actually already at war with Iran through the last parts of the Bush administration. And I think maybe some of the hesitancy to uncover malfeasance by the Bush administration is because they don't want to upset the apple cart and actually look at some of these grotesque things that were going on. And I don't know how you'll respond to that, but it's in the record.
Again, thanks very much for that. I agree with you that at least from Tehran's perspective, there's definitely an issue of being under siege. I mean, if you look at how the Iranians look outside the windows and what they see, you know, 130,000 or so American troops next door in Iraq. They see 20,000 or so U.S. personnel on aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf. They see another 50 or 60,000 in Afghanistan, and then not to mention the other neighboring states. And they do feel threatened by this. There's no doubt about it. The question you raise about the CIA, I don't know. I don't know what, obviously, it would be bad news for the CIA if I knew. But I don't have any information about what they're doing inside the country. What we do know is what you pointed to in the mosque bombing in Zahedan in the Baluch, populated province of Baluchistan with Pakistan. That did happen. Ahmadinejad actually had to cancel his trip there. Baluch insurgency, however, has something that's been going on for decades. Even the pro-Shah monarch that was the ruler in Iran before the revolution of 79 had to deal with the insurgency. And ironically, the United States actually provided him assistance in cracking down on some of those insurgents back in the 60s. And they have issues among their Kurds and some of the ethnic Arabs that live on the border with Iraq. But all these things, if you look at them combined, just to give you one example, Iran's current cabinet that has just been approved by the parliament, the number of people that Ahmadinejad put up were approved. None of these people, for example, included a Sunni member, somebody from the Sunni minority in the country. That created criticism from the 10% of Iran's population that's made up of Sunnis. I give you that as an example of policy shortcomings on the part of the Iranians. If they acted differently, they could reduce some of the tensions in some of the border regions and so forth. That's not to say foreign agencies are not at all involved in Iran. That might be the case. But I'm saying you can't just put everything that goes wrong in Iran at the door of foreign and intelligence services and say that's why they are obviously upset with Washington. But your point about U.S. funding going into affairs relating to Iran is valid. I mean, the United States Congress is, I believe it's $75 million to try and, help the Iranian civil society get the information to Iran and so forth. And from Tehran's perspective, that is meddling. That is to sort of undermine the regime. And that's one of the issues that if U.S.-Iran diplomatic relations were ever going to be reestablished, has to be tackled, dealt with.
We are a bit past our midpoint here. I've got some other callers, and I want to get on to some others and also reintroduce our guest, Alex Vatanka. He is a senior Middle East analyst with Jane's Information Group. Since March of 2006, he's also been managing editor of Jane's Islamic Affairs Analyst and also Jane's Intelligence Digest. He is, in addition, an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. He's frequently appeared on media outlets, including the BBC, the CNN, and CBC. He's written for a number of publications, including Christian Science Monitor and World Today. We're talking this morning about Iran, and your questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next, we will talk with someone in Urbana. This is line two. Hello.
First, I'd like to compliment the speaker for having corrected that first caller about never being free elections in the Middle East. I believe you cited the 52 elections in Iran, which were really quite democratic. And I suppose the elections pre-1980 in Lebanon were free, if you can call the system democratic. Very convoluted and almost Byzantine system. But anyway, what I really wanted to object to was the language of the caller. The shikes and sipes expression really has no place in intelligent discourse. And I think he should be severely reprimanded. It's like calling someone the N-word in this country. I'd also like to say I think I agree with the caller about American interference in Iranian affairs during the Bush administration. I think that was completely counterproductive. Thank you.
All right. Very well. I don't know if you want to respond to that at all.
No, I'm you know, I just want to say that the issue of the United States and Iran facing one another off in the Middle East is given. I mean, if you are the U.S. and you are in a number of countries, and Iran, let's not forget, is by far the largest country in the Middle East. That's 71 million people. There are more people in Iran than there are in Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and all the other states on the Arabian Peninsula combined. The Iranian state is big. It's powerful in many ways, and it's involved in a whole host of arenas. So to expect friction, I think, would be natural, particularly since that they don't always see eye to eye on so many issues.
Yeah. All right, let's talk with someone in Effingham, line four. Hello.
Yes, I would like you to address from the inception to progress in international affairs and Iran and the Middle East in particular, over the Middle East and Iran in particular, and the influence of oil.
You know, I can tell you that in the case of Iran, they have struggled for decades to try and minimize their reliance of exporting oil and the revenue that comes with it. They haven't succeeded. You know, oil has been and continues to provide about 80% of the Iranian national budget today. Without it, they would be in deep trouble. What they also face right now, and I just want to focus on Iran, is they want to diversify their energy partners, and their nuclear stalemate with the West is making it very difficult for them to do that. So they're still basically living along the lines, the same trade pattern that has existed in Iran for decades. What they want to do is to create new markets, and this non-relations with the United States is making that impossible. To give you one concrete example, Iran has the second largest natural gas reserves in the world. The Russian Federation and Iran, these two states alone, account for about half of the world's natural gas. It's an astonishing figure. The Russians are freely selling their natural gas to Europe. The Iranians can't even get to it because they don't have access to the kind of technology they need. One of the technologies that would be very useful for them is LNG, the liquefied natural gas technology, to get to that natural gas that they have so plenty of and sell it. Because they don't have relations with the United States and the U.S. is sort of the authority when it comes to that kind of technology, they can't do it. So that's one concrete example of how oil and gas are important for them economically, and why this non-relations with the United States continues to be the big obstacle in their way to not free themselves from energy, because that's not going to happen in the short term, but try and reduce the reliance that they have on a handful of partners that actually purchase their oil. And
All right. Well, again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked about the reaction to the elections in June, and I think people are aware that there was a very aggressive crackdown by the government against the demonstrators. There were people who were killed. There were a lot of people who were put in jail. There have been reports about people being tortured and possibly some people actually dying in police custody. So as far as the opposition is concerned, there is this feeling that they need to be careful. And in fact, I think Mir Hussein Mousavi has said that people who are supporting him should indeed be careful not to give the government an excuse to react in that way again. So at the same time, it seems as the opposition is trying to say we have to be cool here about what we do, but they haven't gone away. I don't think that we've seen demonstrations like we saw back after the elections. But so the question is, well, what is the state of the opposition now, and do you think that it will continue to be a significant force in Iranian politics?
You know, there are a couple of factors that come to mind right away. One is the position of the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei. He has, as the ultimate final authority when it comes to politics in that country, despite the fact he likes to pretend he's just a religious figurehead, he's very much a micro-level manager of political affairs in that country. His position is very important. He is in charge of so many of these agencies that it can actually make life very difficult for the president. By doing so, can also help the opposition if he chose to go down that path. So far, he's done nothing like it because, as I said earlier, he fears the opposition's end objective is to get rid of this regime as we know it, to reduce the powers of the Supreme Leader, and that's obviously not in Ayatollah's best of interest, at least from his perspective. So we should be very careful and be watchful about what Khamenei does. As I said, so far he has been pretty much aligned with Ahmadinejad, but we've also seen tension between the two men. Because if Ahmadinejad, and remember, Ahmadinejad is a radical populist. We look at him as an Islamist, but above all, I think he's a radical populist. And if his populism starts actually hurting the regime, and when I talk about the regime, I'm talking about the inner circle that's actually now in charge of running the state. If they start feeling that the regime's survival is at stake because of some of the policies of Ahmadinejad, that's the kind of moment where you could perhaps envisage Khamenei intervening and putting, a stop to whatever it is Ahmadinejad is seeking to do. Because remember, he does have that power. He does have the power to, for instance, on legislation issues, to tell the president that that's not something he's going to approve of, do it again and do it again. So we haven't seen him do that so far. He can do that. And again, he could also pave the way for the opposition. For instance, as the head of the judiciary, he can put a stop to these Stalinist-like trials that have been taking place in Iran. He can free some of the prisoners who are still in Iran because, again, he is the ultimate voice over the judicial branch. He's also the chief commander-in-chief of all the armed forces in the country. He can, famously, he shut down one of the prisons in Tehran when it was discovered three people had been tortured to death. He has a whole host of areas where he can be very effective. So far, he's been very cautious because, as I said, it goes back to this fundamental fear he has. If I neutralize Ahmadinejad very strongly, what would I end up with? Because the reformists, some of the reformist supporters, remember, were shouting not long ago, death to the dictator, death to Khamenei, the supreme leader. He's heard those slogans. He's fearful that the reformists, more so to this day still, than he is about Ahmadinejad. But as I said, that equation can change depending on where Ahmadinejad takes the country next 4 years.
Yeah. You know, I think that almost everywhere in the Middle East, I've read stories that talk about demographics and talk about the significant pressures that are coming to bear or perhaps will come to bear on governments as a result of the fact that a big percentage of the population are young. And I guess that probably means, I don't know, people under 20 or under 30. And that their expectations are not being fulfilled and that that's a real challenge for many governments. One of those places you read that is Iran, where there seems to be a great generational gulf between the leadership of the country, who tend to be older, and a very significant piece of the population that are younger, that don't connect with the older generation, the ruling clerics, don't support them. And so one wonders how that kind of tension is likely to play out over time, and would we get to a point where a very significant number of Iranians simply won't support the ruling clerics anymore?
You know, David, if I'm not mistaken, about 70% or roughly 70% of the population of Iran is under the age of 30. So that's a pretty young population. Having said that, the growth, the population growth has declined dramatically over the recent years, and it's now equal to what you see in terms of population growth of sort of average West European country. But the fact is, there was a huge population growth in the 80s, and a lot of these people are now already entered the job market or about to enter the job market, and the regime is not in a position for various reasons to provide them with jobs. They need to create about 700,000 jobs a year, and there's just there's a long way before they can get to that mark. This is not just unique to Iran. Egypt, for instance, have similar sort of statistics. They all have similar problems. But in Iran's case, they also have a huge brain drain issue, which, again, long-term will make the economy suffer. They have, according by IMF, about 150,000 of Iran's best and brightest leave the country each year. You know, there will be a price to pay for that sort of brain drain. And this is one of the arguments the opposition has made, which is, look, Ahmadinejad and his supporters are creating a police state. It's their way or the highway, so to speak. And that's not how you're going to keep the young Iranians that the nation needs for its long-term survival and prosperity to stay. So that was one of the main arguments on Mousavi against Ahmadinejad, saying, you know, for instance, picking up this issue of foreign policies and saying to Ahmadinejad, Mr. President, you want to reorder the international structures of power. With what tools in the box are you going to do that? And, you know, what planet are you on? We don't have the powers. Let's recognize what our strengths are, but also recognize what our weaknesses are and start acting realistically. And you famously, Mousavi, said to Ahmadinejad, the Iranian nuclear program, for instance, you cannot describe that as a locomotive without brakes, that if we have to compromise, we have to compromise because not everything comes down to the nuclear issue. So, you know, again, all this ties into this distinct worldviews that the two individuals, in particular Mousavi and Ahmadinejad, put forward, one saying, yes, Iran can change the world order, and Mousavi saying no, and we have to be much more realistic about what Iran can achieve and aim for something that can be arrived at.
Yeah. Well, we're coming down to the point here where we have maybe about 5 minutes. So one thing I certainly do want to touch on is the concern of many of Iran's neighbors and other countries around the world about the nuclear issue and about Iran's seeming determination to produce nuclear weapons, although Iran, I think, all along has said that their interest is having a civilian nuclear program for energy production. There was also concern that they might make nuclear bombs, and apparently there are reports that they have continued to accumulate the fissionable material, the stuff that you would need to make a bomb. Perhaps they have not gone all the way to putting together a device, but there is this worry that they might. And this has a couple of dimensions. It certainly has an internal political dimension and an external political dimension. Is there some way, do you think, if the rest of the world decides they would rather not see a nuclear Iran, is there some way to persuade the government not to take those steps and go all the way to building a functioning nuclear device?
Well, David, to this day, and remember, the Iranian nuclear program came to light in sort of late 2002, and these negotiations back and forth between Iran, Western powers, and sort of deliberations taking place at the United Nations Security Council have been going on ever since. One of the issues that are obviously still missing is concrete evidence of this weaponization of the nuclear program in Iran. To this day, and the sort of August report came out on the 28th of last month, and it talked about Iran increasing the number of centrifuges enriching uranium. But again, there's no smoking gun, so to speak. There's no evidence that this is what Iran is up to. There is a lot of suspicion based on what the Iranians are doing that might ultimately what they want. But there's no concrete evidence. And obviously, given what happened with Iraq, a lot of people, a lot of states are very skeptical about just going with suspicions as a way of punishing the Iranians. The Iranians, on their part, saying they're members of the NPT. They have every sovereign right to have enrichment of uranium on their soil and so forth. And by the way, this issue of enriching uranium is very much supported across the board in Iran. So, for instance, none of those people who absolutely cannot stand Ahmadinejad, in actual terms, are likely in the long term to give up the enrichment of uranium because it has such a national support at home. What they are saying is, let's change tact. Let's negotiate. If we have to create goodwill, if they have to help the Western states to sort of be less suspicious, then let's do that. Let's take those steps, and let's not be totally fixated by, you know, having to have the entire nuclear cycle on Iranian soil. In terms of Iran's neighbors, obviously they're suspicious because, look, this is a regime that came to power and the revolutionary message. To some extent, it's still revolutionary. You look at Iranian influence in places like Lebanon among the Palestinians and so forth. A lot of those countries are looking at Iran thinking, well, what would happen if Iran actually decided to go all the way and weaponize? What would that do to Iranian attitude? Would that make that country far more emboldened in terms of what it does? And that is what creates anxiety. I don't really know at this stage. I mean, the Iranians yesterday have come up with a new set of proposals to try and break this stalemate. We don't know if this new set of proposals are going to be any different from the other ones. But as I said again, nothing concrete will happen on the international scene in terms of fourth round of sanctions, and bear in mind the three sets of sanctions have been imposed on Iran. We can't expect a fourth set of harsh set of sanctions on Iran unless something comes out of the UN that says, yes, we now have the concrete evidence that they are weaponizing. Till that day, I think it's just going to be a slow process of they sort of continuing what they've been doing since 2002 when it was sort of came to light.
Yeah. We just have about 5-6 minutes left. Just very quickly, I should introduce again our guest. We're talking here this morning with Alex Fatanka. He's a senior Middle East analyst with Jane's Information Group, also adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. We're talking about Iran. Well, this last point you touched on was certainly something that I wanted to try to come back to, and that is it seems that the Iranians, at least, they're talking about talking. One doesn't know exactly where that will go. Some people have taken the jaundiced view that says, well, that's just a kind of a stalling tactic, that they're not really interested. They're just interested in prolonging this kind of uncertain period here where they can continue to pursue whatever it is they want to pursue. So at this point, sounds as if you're saying one really doesn't know what, if anything, this would amount to.
Let me just, David, if I could, make an analogy to a country that actually recently has detonated, tested nuclear weapons, North Korea. The Iranians are very, very different from North Korea. You know, North Korea is totally isolated. They survive on their own. They don't export or import much. Iran is totally dependent on trade. And this is a regime that's very much is aware that if there are harsh sanctions, like, for instance, Iraq experienced in the 1990s, that if people's ability to buy basic goods because of sanctions are going to be dramatically impacted, then a lot of the people in Iran today who are on the fence, who are watching this political debacle, but are actually not involved on the street level, they will be involved on the street level. They will face Ahmadinejad and his security forces, or for that matter, Khamenei, and that's what the regime fears. And this is what they are very have to be very careful about in terms of making sure that they do at least enough to make sure a fourth round of UN sanctions, are not imposed on the country because the consequences of that can be very severe. The economy is absolutely the weakest of not just Ahmadinejad, but entire regime. And as I said again, they depend on trade. They have to sell the oil. They import a lot of things. And how people very often are just kept neutral, at least politically, is because they get by. Sanctions will make that much more difficult, and that's why Tehran is so sensitive to this issue.
One kind of last point here, unfortunately, we have about a minute or two, and I'm not sure if this is something that I picked up on in reading comments of yours or other analysts, but I think it's an interesting point, and that is for all of the inflammatory rhetoric that we have heard from Mr. Ahmadinejad, actually, if you look at Iran's foreign policy, it tends to be rather cautious and pragmatic. So I suppose that means that one has to separate out what is said, particularly what Mr. Ahmadinejad says, and then what the country actually does.
No, absolutely. I think that is true, particularly now, although you could have made the case, much stronger case, for what Iran did in the early 80s, right after the revolution was sort of Islamic Republic was created. They were far more revolutionary, and sort of the idea of exporting the revolution was much more at the forefront than it is today. Yes, they have been much more pragmatic.
But the question is, if Ahmadinejad and the sort of far right that is around him, if they get their way, would that pragmatism continue? And that's a big question. I mean, a lot of the pragmatism that we have still to this day is a legacy of what the reformist president Mohammad Khatami put in place between 97 and 2005. And remember, you know, the point, I guess, is depends on one's perspective. If you are an anti-Hezbollah political activist in Lebanon, you don't really care about what how pragmatic the Iranian influence in Lebanon is. The fact that there's an Iranian influence, from your point of view, is meddling. So it really comes down to perspective as well.
Yeah. Well, so now, what would there be anything in particular to watch for as a kind of clue as to how things are going to go in Iran, at least over the next year or two?
You know, I think the most interesting aspect right now, I don't know if it can go as far as, say, 1 or 2 years. I don't know if it will be able to drag on for that long, is this purge that I sort of mentioned at the outset. If they go after Mousavi, and remember, some of Ahmadinejad's supporters want to put Mousavi on trial as an American CIA-paid agent. You go after someone like Mousavi and his backers, that includes Ayatollah Hashemi Rafsanjani, arguably one of the most influential political forces in Iran, then I don't know how this regime can survive as an Islamic republic. Either, you know, Khamenei becomes essentially sidelined, he's just a figurehead, he doesn't have the political powers. Exactly what he is feared happened to him at the hands of the reformers will happen to him at the hands of the far right. And I think that's the scenario he is equally worried about. But, I mean, if Khamenei could have it, he will tell everyone to take a step back for the sake of the regime to survive and carry on the day, to end this acrimonious infighting, because, as he would put it, is where are they going to go? Which country is going to provide them asylum if the regime as a whole collapsed? I mean, all of them have some sort of records that they have to answer for. So, yeah, that is the ultimate best scenario from Khamenei's point of view. Whether he can do that or not, that's a whole different matter, because this infighting is so nasty, so colorful, that you just have to wonder, can they contain it? Can they have some sort of a marriage of convenience that will last long into the future?
There we'll have to leave it. Our guest, Alex Vatanka, is Senior Middle East Analyst with Jane's Information Group, adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Mr. Vatanka, thank you very much.
Thank you, David, for having me on the show.